Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Thursday morning edition of the Roundtable and our panel discussion. Just a lot of fun to be with you. Thank you very much for having us and for listening and for being with us this morning. We really do appreciate it, and we love you for it. Thank you. Look, we have a lot to talk about this morning, and we're going to get started. We have a wonderful group, as we always do. And I just want to thank them in advance for being here. And you know, does it sound like I'm vamping? Well, it is, because they're they're finishing up the taping of the media project, so we're just waiting for Alan to arrive and all that stuff. But that won't keep me from introducing the rest of our great cast, and also remind you that you can get in on the conversation. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will, you know, consider your letter. How's that? We'll consider it. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce our group to you. The man who I, less than an hour ago, I called at his home, and I doubt I woke him up, of course, but it was very nice that he took my call, and I said, oh, we have a cancellation. Will you be on the show? And he said, yes. Mike Spain, thank you very much for being here, as always.
And my pleasure, Joe. Very happy to be here on this very beautiful day.
Yeah, it is. Very pretty. It was a pretty ride in this morning. We also welcome Teresa Bourgeois back to the show. She is the Cohoes City Director of Operations, which means she does everything in the city of Cohoes. Anything.
Except the garbage?
Yeah, well, she knows who does, and if the garbage isn't picked up, Teresa, you get a call, don't you?
Right.
She was out this morning shoveling snow.
This week, and I started Tidy Up Tuesdays with volunteers helping to clean up garbage. So, yep, we're all about in
wow.
Historic Cohoes. We're
impressive.
Restoring historic Cohoes.
I'm sorry, Tidy Up Tuesday.
Yes, Tidy Up Tuesdays. We have volunteers who on Tuesdays help tidy up parts of our city. It's wonderful.
Mike, you're a Tuesday regular. You have to remind me of that. Tidy Up Tuesday.
I shall.
That's very good. Well, greetings to you, Teresa. Tetherless World.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, and a man someday I will understand fully what he does, Jim Henwer. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, John. I'm good. And the day you figure it out, please tell me.
You'll have to change jobs.
Yeah, it's very impressive. But
if we knew, we'd have to kill you.
That's what I was thinking.
And Alan, I introduced you this morning. I would have gone to you first, but you were finishing up on Media Project.
You were.
How did that go? Everything all right? You good?
Yeah.
Okay.
I say the same thing every week.
Okay. Well, you'll want to listen into the Media Project.
I call it the three against one show. You know, there's, yeah, you know, I'm the odd man out because I think that newspapers are capable of doing some very bad things, and the people who work for them are. So usually that raises a certain amount of animus, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, that seems like a good show, and we look forward to listening to that. It's on Sundays.
Hey, in fairness,
Sundays. Yeah,
you know, some broadcasters.
It's easy for you to say.
Right.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for being with us. We are thrilled that you are here, as I mentioned. All right, let's begin. So, what's up with Kevin McCarthy, huh? Let's talk about this, the top House Republican who refuses to take action on Marjorie Taylor Greene, and he did... Well, I don't know what people were expecting. I don't even know quite what I was expecting. But ultimately, what has happened here is that Marjorie Taylor Greene and her past remarks on conspiracy theories and violence were denounced by House Republican Kevin McCarthy. But she was not removed, at least by McCarthy, from the jobs that he gave her, the roles that he gave her on two committees. So that then turns and forces a vote today on the entire House to decide. And then he criticized, McCarthy criticized Democrats for forcing the vote over removing her from congressional committees because it's their fault that, I don't know, they didn't do their, that they were upset that she was crazy? I don't know. Then the other part of this, of course, was Liz Cheney, who had the audacity to vote for the articles or to support impeachment, and also her concern over the insurrection on January 6th, and she was, after being spoken down to, or spoken to, I should say, she kept her leadership post yesterday. So, but the big news will be the vote today. And maybe I'm reading this wrong, Alan. You help me here as a political scientist. But if you're the Democrats, sure, maybe Kevin McCarthy is blaming you for forcing the vote. But it wouldn't have been forced had he done his job, number one. And number two, now Democrats are given this gift of, for all of the Republicans that they have to run against in 2 years, to have them on record of how and if they support this woman who has just said the nuttiest of things.
Well said, Joe. That's exactly right. Look, I keep thinking of what nickname, I like to give nicknames to people, and I'm wondering about McCarthy. He could be Edgar Bergen's dummy, known as Charlie.
Charlie McCarthy. I got it.
Yeah.
The name connection, I got it.
Because sitting on Trump's knee, you know what I mean? Or he could be called a faux Solomon because he, you know, talking about cutting the baby in half. So, you know, I don't. He gives something to both of those people. Obviously, Liz Cheney is to be respected for what she did here, and might be turn out to be one of the saviors of the Republican Party, because there are some sane people in the Republican Party if they can get it back to where it once was. In the meantime, Trump's numbers among Republicans are going down precipitously. I read a poll just showing that going through the floor. And that is really fascinating to me. So McCarthy, he's worried about survival, his own personal survival, his leadership of his conference. And yet he really is powerless to do anything that will save them the way that he's going now. How do you say anything good, or how do you support the continuation of a woman who's an outright anti-Semite, who is really saying that the parents of those children who were slaughtered, you know, that it was it never happened, that 9/11 never happened. I mean, this is really a wacko of the first order, and the fact that he has to defend her and others have to defend her tells you too much about who they are.
Well, I thought one of the most offensive parts of Kevin McCarthy's remarks last night was the butchering of Charlie, of the butchering of the name of QAnon, of like, I've never even heard of this. I don't know what this is. And, you know, I talked to her for an hour. She didn't mention anything about space lasers. Come on. You know, I mean, really, the ignorance of not even knowing. I'd be more worried if that were even true, that he didn't know what was going on and hadn't picked up a paper in a really long time. Teresa Bourgeois, what do you make of all this?
I think it's a reminder of the pretty serious cultural problems we have right now, these deep, deep divides. I was reading, you know, some of the tweets about what happened, and one of the members of Congress described the situation with Congresswoman Cheney as facing, quote unquote, 4 hours of blistering criticism, and that she didn't yield an inch. But 4 hours of blistering criticism. On the other hand, there are reports that Congresswoman Green, you know, was applauded. And so what's happening in our country, or
by the way,
with the Republican,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but literally applauded, right? I mean, literally applauded. Yes, go ahead.
So Congresswoman Cheney, who, let's remember what she did. She supported the peaceful transfer of power, right? She supported the peaceful transfer of power and supported the free, you know, the elections in our country. And she gets blistering criticism. And Congresswoman Green, we know all of the things. And sorry about the phone. I'm trying to make it stop.
Okay.
You know, gets the
somebody's calling about their garbage.
Applause.
These phones have
right for.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Teresa.
And she gets the applause. And so, how does that happen? How does it happen that 60 people? Yes, Cheney prevailed, but 60 people voted against her. 60 members of Congress voted against the person who supported the peaceful transfer of power. We have to understand how that happens, and my concern is that we have a real problem in this country with disinformation,
right.
And that is causing serious, I mean, this is not news, but problems for our democracy.
And
so, yes, I mean, Kevin McCarthy's just doing what he does to try to save his leadership position and shift the focus to the Democrats, but we have a much bigger cultural problem that needs to be focused on.
And I don't, I agree with everything you just said, but just for a note, that vote was a secret ballot, so those people can go under the cover of darkness.
You said people, you mean cowards.
Yes, I did mean cowards. Mike,
what does it say when you...
But
Alan, what does it say when 60 yeah. people voted... where, you know, their vote was not going to be public, and yet they still voted against Liz Cheney?
Well, it means a couple of things. One, it may mean that they actually believe it, which I find personally hard to believe. And another is that they are the kinds of political prostitutes that we know all too well, will do anything to cover their butts so that they can survive. That's what that's all about. You know, the idea that they actually believe it is so hard for me personally to get.
Jim Hanler, go ahead.
So, you know, I think there's some really interesting things. I've been trying to dig into some of the underlying data and things like that. You know, one of the things that I found interesting, and Alan, you may know more about this than I do, if you look at fundraising patterns and things like that, you know, we've always said that the Democrats are more like a set of different parties, where the Republicans were a little more monolithic. You know, what I realize is Democratic fundraising is coming in much larger, smaller pieces these days. And Republican fundraising still includes a lot of very big chunks from PACs and things. So I have a feeling that the Republicans as a party are more challenged by when they're not seen as a monolithic party than the Democrats who've lived that way. And I think what we're seeing is an interesting trend where the Democrats now have to pull together because of the small majorities they have. And the Republicans are sort of having this split that they're going to have to work out in this sort of polarized space because they're going to sort of have to figure out where the money's going. So I think in a real politic way, there's something very interesting playing out here that's going to have some long-term implications.
I would also point out to your very good point, in addition, money tends to follow two things. Fear, right? I mean, people were really scared to death about what this country was coming to, and the Democrats were making huge inroads into fundraising. We know that. Even with the big guys doing what they were doing or not doing what they were doing. So that's one thing. But money also tends to follow power. And right now, all the power is in two houses of the Congress and a president.
Right.
And so that makes sense also.
Mike Spain.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say, I read that I'm talking about Green, raised $110,000 in one day this week. Money is pouring into her also. And although she isn't speaking to what we regard as the establishment press, she did talk to the Washington Examiner, and she said that the Republicans and the establishment Republicans and the Democrats in Congress are no different. She was eager to bring more action-oriented people to Congress like her. And, you know, that's scary. She's kind of leading this new insurgent Republican area, group that is apparently gaining some steam. But I just want to say about Cheney's vote. Yeah, 60 people did vote. against keeping Cheney as the leader when it was a secret ballot, and that is disturbing. But 145 Republicans voted to keep her, and that's a sizable majority. And it does show that more Republicans are closer to the mainstream. They're just afraid to say it in public. And today, we may see that when they have to vote on whether to, you know, strip Green from her committee assignments, because that's going to be an open vote. And you're right, Joe. I mean, it's going to become material in 2 years when every one of those congressmen run for reelection.
2 years is a long time, Mike.
Well, but how can you be on the...
Hold on. Go ahead, Mike.
Sorry.
No, it is and it isn't. That's all. I mean, you know, 2 years can go by quickly. Already,
yes.
The campaign is underway.
Right. The ads have already started. I mean, the negative ads have already started by the Democrats looking to, mm-hmm. you know, of including that vote. Teresa, you were going to say, I'm sorry.
Mike, how can she serve on the House Education Committee, given what she has said about school shootings?
Oh, I agree with you completely. That's preposterous. And there was a negotiation going on with Steny Hoyer, you know, who's like the whip for the Democrats in the House, where she would be assigned to some labor committee or something, or, you know, some benign committee where she'd be sorted out of the way. And Democrats wouldn't allow it. They really want the Republicans to do this. And Alan, you said the other day, and I agree, you know, it's risky for the Democrats to strip a Republican from a committee assignment, because it could come back to haunt them, just the way that ending the filibuster for judges came back to haunt them with the Supreme Court appointments. You know, so it's, you know, you got to think down the road. And yet, if somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene can keep her position on the Education Committee after calling what happened in Parkland a false flag and saying it was an act and it was intended to help
take
guns.
A break.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. We do. And we'll, but we'll get more. I promise. We'll talk about this more when we continue.
Please. Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain. Just before the break, we were talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene and the vote that will take place today in the House of Representatives. Jim, I know you wanted in on the conversation.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, I thought what Mike was saying was very interesting, in part because it was the dinner table argument between my wife and myself last night. And,
Mike was there. He's everywhere.
Yeah, she actually won. So
well, that's good to know.
I mean, I was kind of making the real politic argument that, you know, what happens in 2 years if the Republicans take it out and, you know, they'll go after AOC and others. And, you know, my wife convinced me that, yes, but, you know, you can't leave somebody like this on the Education Committee. You can't give this person the megaphone. And, you know, she's right. There's got to be a line somewhere. Otherwise, we just stay on these sort of slippery slope arguments saying you can never censor someone. You can never do this. You can never do that. And I think, you know, in this case, it's so egregious. Of course, my whole thing, all my Twitter and Facebook feeds are filled with space laser jokes. So, you know, Jewish space laser was one of her crazy conspiracy theories. So, you know, it's you can treat her as a laughing matter, but what my wife really pointed out to me was it's not a laughing matter. This is a person who, you know, on the Ed Committee would actually have some power over some of these things.
Right.
And, you know, the Republicans, it was a very in-your-face move to put her on that committee.
And the question, of course, is what the Democrats choose to do with this. This is a great gift. She's a great gift to the Democrats. No question in my mind about that. Now, if they threw her out of the place, it would be a terrible error. But taking the committees away, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to stop right there.
Well, see, I don't think it's a gift, Alan, because, I think this is a, you know, first of all, this is a distraction from what they need to be talking about, but it's a critical distraction because we have to address these issues. And I think that she is, you know, they can't let her stay on the committee. But she's also threatened the speaker. And so some of the Republicans say, well, these were words that were spoken prior to her becoming a member of Congress, so you're going to be held accountable for what you've previously said. Well, she has not only not refuted that, she has doubled down on saying she stands by what she says. But the question is, Jim, you spoke about the fact that, you know, this is a very polarized space. How did it get this way? How did we get to the point where there is, you know, support for 60 people think it's appropriate for them to vote this way against our democracy and applaud her? And I'm really concerned about disinformation in this country and how that's being fostered and what we can do about that. There's an interesting op-ed in the New York Times recently by Shoshana Zuboff, I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, but about the age of surveillance and how the amassing of information is used not only to predict behavior but to influence it. And how is micro-targeting influencing people's behavior and building up support for groups like QAnon, and that's just, it's not based on any fact, but it's gaining strength, or for building support for people like her. This is a deep-seated problem in our country.
Joe, write a reply, like it or not. Let me just say, Teresa, I just don't want anybody putting, and I think in some way you did that, putting words in my mouth as support for Marjorie Taylor Greene. That is not the case.
Oh, no, I don't think you would support her for a nanosecond, Alan.
No. But I do think the Democrats are going to make hay out of this. Look, we have a by-election coming up in which the Democrats, as you know better than anybody having worked in Congress, are really slated to lose. They are, because it's a by-election and because that's what happens when a president goes into power. Usually people cover their butts the next time. So I'm just simply saying the Democrats are going to use this like crazy, and they should. That's
so So to clarify what you were saying earlier, Alan, so do you think will they, and two questions, will they, number one, and two, should they, which is vote to remove her from the committee assignments? I mean, it seems like they will, right?
Yes, it does seem that way. I don't know the answer to that. I think what happens is you give ammunition to the others. Now, on the other hand, the education committee, that foolish McCarthy puts her on the education committee when she's telling parents of dead children who were slaughtered by animals, human animals, that it never happened. That's some qualification for being on an education committee. So,
but
I don't,
Alan,
know on that one. Yeah, go ahead.
Doesn't that allow McCarthy to have the Democrats do his dirty work for him so he doesn't get blamed for it and
she
gets
removed? Yeah, we don't want that. That's exactly right. And that's, I think, what my point was to clarify, which is you don't want the Democrats to be setting up a precedent here and taking the elephant off the backs of, mixed metaphor, of the Republicans. Let them sit there. Every time she were to open her mouth on the Education Committee, she'd get real hell for whatever she said. So I agree with you.
But how does a Democrat not vote to take, I mean, how does somebody, name a representative, a Democratic representative, and say, well, how do you not vote to remove her from the committee?
Because, Joe, you are assuming a vote. As Teresa will tell you, and as we saw with McConnell and his Republicans, you don't, and you're in control, there's not going to be a vote if you don't want a vote. So the fact that there is does embarrass a whole bunch of people into doing what's right, I suspect. But you're right. You're right, Joe. That's the question.
I mean, but so my understanding is there is going to be a vote as of right now, correct?
Because it's allowed.
Right.
Because the leader of the the House of Representatives, as opposed to the Senate, is really, really strict when it comes to the rules and allowing people to vote and bills that come up. And so we have our wonderful Jim McGovern, who is we interview on the radio all the time, who's the head of the powerful Rules Committee. You can create a rule which allows it or doesn't allow it. That's my point.
Jim?
Yes, so I think that, again, I think it's a tough thing for both sides. And you know, what worries me is we're seeing a middle getting left out here. the place where sort of compromise used to happen is getting smaller and smaller. I still remember, it's almost 10 years ago now, I saw Bill Bradley talking about some of this stuff. And, you know, he was talking about when he was in Congress, you had a very large group in the middle who had run on compromise and things like that. And you know, over time, that's gotten down to, you know, now we talk about three or four people. We talk about 10 people who crossed over as a major thing. We've moved away from the days where, you know, sort of we had times where Clinton, to get something through, had to count on Republican votes, where, you know, Bush actually had to, you know, would make some changes and get some Democrats to vote. And now, you know, we're seeing these things like happened in healthcare and beyond, where there's not a single vote from the opposite party. When you look at, you know, sort of the confirmation votes on people, they used to be 95 or 98 in favor. Now, you know, 53 is considered a strong vote. So it's kind of a crazy situation. You hate to see things that play into it. On the other hand, again, there are egregious things. At some point, you have to draw a line and say, this just is crazy. And I think this was an example of that.
We got some letters like this one from Carol, who says the Republican House members voted overwhelmingly for Liz Cheney to keep her position of party leadership. Their secret ballot vote shows how they really feel about what direction the GOP should take.
What does that say about them? You know, these spineless, terrible people who know what's right, who continually talk about patriotism, and who, when it comes time for their turn to be patriotic and to put themselves at risk, they won't do it. And yes, the letter writer is exactly right about you know, about being identified.
So get ready, because one of our listeners is quoting Voltaire. Kenneth says, hello, panel. I hang on your every word. Here is a quote from the great philosopher and wit Voltaire. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities.
I visited him in his burial place. I just want you to know that.
Okay.
I was going to say, I didn't think you were old enough to visit.
Actually, well, yeah.
That's
a dinner with Voltaire.
But
yeah.
I am pretty old.
Yeah, Jim.
John,
but,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, you know, channeling Malcolm a little bit. He's not here today, but, you know, I think, so actually something that grew out of some of the conversations we were having on this panel a couple months ago about QAnon and things like that, I've actually started working with some of my colleagues. We're actually looking at how modeling how the conspiracy theories are spreading and really looking at, you know, we're calling it finding the spider in the web. You know, how are people guiding these things? So it's been very interesting. I've been spending a lot of my time down on the parts of the web that are totally insane and seeing that stuff. And, you know, you really see that there's this craziness that's being exploited by a political class in a way that's never happened before. There's always been conspiracy theorists. There's always been a few crazies around. You know, there was a woman elected, I believe it was in Florida some, you know, 15, 20 years ago, who believed in this whole conspiracy that the British had never really given up America. And she ran on that. You know, I mean, you know, I used to see crazy people sitting outside grocery stores in Texas with petitions from, I'm blanking on his name, the crazy politician who
Lyndon
believed
LaRoche.
Every conspiracy. LaRoche, like, yeah, so, you know, it's not that these people haven't been there before. It's that, one, they didn't get the social media amplification. That's something Teresa was referring to before in that op-ed. But the other one is, they really weren't being exploited by, they were being marginalized by the major parties. The Tea Party grew up out of that sort of LaRouche base and other people like that, but said, hey, we can turn this into a political movement. We can capitalize on the hate. And that, of course, is what led to Trumpism and all the things we've discussed before. So it's really this amplification between the spread of the conspiracy theory, the utilization of that by politics, and that becomes a self-amplifying loop that's scary.
We're
going to have to break it somehow.
We do have more letters, and I want to get to those. Teresa, sorry. Make your point, and then we'll take a break and come back and discuss this further. Go ahead.
I was just, Jim, isn't that what Cambridge Analytica was all about in terms of that exploitation and understanding really how to identify and foment this for the purposes of growing their base?
Arguably, yes. I mean, they certainly did some of that. This question of how effective they were versus other people, but yes, absolutely.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the letters, and we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Let's go to some letters. Kim writes to us and says, at my job, if you get written up three times, you get a pink slip and you're out. Marjorie Taylor Greene needs to be censured for comments made strike one. Removed from her committee assignments, strike two. And charged with making a hostile work environment, threatening members with violence, strike three. See you later. Also, wasn't Ilhan Omar censured for making comments considered racist? That happened fairly quickly, too. Well, that is the comparison that is often being made, right, Teresa, between on the Republican side of saying, well, your person did it, too, but there's a big difference between the comments, which should be noted.
Right. I mean, I think we have to remember. So here, for instance, in one post in January 2009, she wasn't a congresswoman at the time, liked a comment that said, quote, a bullet to the head would be quicker, close quote, to remove House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I mean, and other quotes about deep state executing FBI agents who were, in her eyes, part of the quote unquote deep state. So not only is it the Parkland shooting issues, which are egregious enough, but her deep dive into QAnon conspiracies and her liking, sharing information, like putting a bullet to the head would be quicker to remove the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I mean, this is extremely egregious.
And now she serves with Nancy Pelosi on the House floor.
And now she serves with Nancy Pelosi.
Right. Sergey writes us, and I like his letter. It says, Green is acting like the two-year-old who has discovered that she can get a lot of attention by saying words like poopy. I like that letter, but of course what she's saying is a lot worse than that. John.
But it is the case that space laser was a trending topic on Twitter, which takes a lot of work.
Well, yeah. And
that's a lot like poopy.
John says,
space lasers.
John says the behavior of Kevin McCarthy sounds like an abuser. Compare. It's you, Democrats, your fault that I appointed Marjorie Taylor Greene to those committees. It's your fault that I beat you for making me angry. I've seen this comparison made between the Republicans and abusers several times in several situations. Interesting point from John. Greg writes and says, listening to the news quite a bit lately with QAnon being discussed and Marjorie Taylor Greene, one thing does surprise me. The more broadcasters are not mentioning that QAnon and its theories are actually a cult. Breaking away from a cult is quite challenging. Then we go to Susan. Has Marjorie Taylor Greene given Cruz and Hawley cover for all their miscreant behavior? I haven't heard about them from anyone. Well, this is a question we did address on, I believe, Tuesday's show, in which we asked the question, of all the action that's been taking, not just against Cruz and Hawley, but even against congressional members like Elise Stefanik in our region, where the Lincoln Project has put up ads and so forth, does it take away from that effort when you now have this, obviously, which is, you know, arguably more troubling?
Yeah, it kind of makes Cruz look mainstream. I mean, that's what Green does, and it makes him more tolerable in people's minds because he's not nearly as wacky.
Right. Yeah. Well, he's not that bad, right? I mean, compare
it with her. Wait a minute. Yeah.
I'm saying is that people will say, yes.
Can we add Hawley to this conversation?
Absolutely. But that's the concern, isn't it, that it waters it down?
Well, but, you know, I think it and it almost goes back to that cult thing, which would be a great conversation for another time. This whole self-reinforcing, these whole different subgroups, it's really interesting. But I think, you know, it's worth looking at the fact that there's this real contention on parts of the Republican Party to become the heirs to the power of Trump, whether it's, you know, at the next cycle or several cycles down the road, because some of these people are going to be around a lot longer. And they're really looking at, you know, how they're going to build something out of that base. And to me, again, that's a scary trend in politics that I hope we can stop, because otherwise, you know, we're going to see another Trump in there again, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, or 12 years down the road.
Mm-hmm. Teresa, you asked the very good question, Teresa, a few minutes ago about, you know, how could these people, 60 people, vote this way in a secret ballot? But, you know, the fact is that Marjorie Taylor Greene, with knowledge by her constituents of her views, got elected. Right. I mean, that's the scary part, isn't it?
As did Trump.
Which gets to my larger question, which is, what is driving this in our culture? I mean, you saw yesterday the new Secretary of Defense, Austin. He has a 60-day stand down to discuss extremism in the military.
Yeah.
Right? Related issues. Right? Same thing. It's in the military, it's in among our elected officials. She gets elected. Is this normalized? Cruz's behavior? Is this being normalized? Inciting violence is so frequent that it becomes normalized. I think this is a deep, deep problem, and we need to understand what's driving it. And I think that, and I think some of the issues that Jim is talking about is what is, you know, underneath all of this, in ways that people don't even realize, and the ways that how are people getting their information now?
Alan?
Hasn't this always been around? I mean, we're acting as if this is a brand new thing. I mean, back to Roosevelt, Huey Long, Father Coughlin. They were here, and it was a tough time. You know, you were talking about depression, talking about terrible times in the United States. Then you get into a more easygoing time. But now we're back with a pandemic. We have, although the pandemic wasn't responsible for Trump, I have my own theories on that. I think the Democrats did a lousy job in the election, and he got by a little, even though losing the popular vote, which is something, of course, that he denied. So tough times tend to bring this stuff out.
Well, and to your point, Alan, I mean, to what Teresa was saying, you know, we've normalized this. That was one of the great concerns going into the first days of the Trump administration early in 2017, is how long will it take for this to be normalized? Well, this has clearly been normalized through the 4 years of the Trump administration. All right.
Yes.
We have questions about spiders, so let me get to those. David says, my question is, who is generating this misinformation? Who are the spiders creating the web, and what do they gain? Just because it contains the word web, I go to Jim.
So, well, and I use that spider.
Yes,
title.
I know.
So what we're seeing is that conspiracy theories kind of can grow up naturally, given a place they can be discussed. People see connections between things that aren't really connected and say, hey, when this happens, I think somebody's doing that. What a big part of QAnon has been two things happening. One has been seeding some of that, so saying, hey, are people seeing this thing happening? But an even bigger one has been amplifying some of that. So saying, hey, look, there's these few people over here with a crazy idea. Let's pull it into our mainstream, right? And by creating forums and places to do that, they're able to do that. So the spiders have a lot of different things. Some of them are believers. Some of them are influencers who, you know, make their money by sort of having the sites that a lot of this stuff is happening on, and, you know, you can commoditize the information gained on those kinds of sites. And then some of them now, even more and more, are people who are then sharing this kind of information with the political parties, the modern descendants of Cambridge Analytica, et cetera. So we're really seeing a very interesting slash scary thing playing out there. Malcolm talks about this a lot. And, you know, his particular concern is how it's playing out to white supremacist terrorism, which is very scary. But there's this other thing that's happening that, you know, we're starting to look more at, is how is this influencing the body politic? So, you know, what we're really asking is, who are these spiders? Why are they there? And how do we recognize when this is happening so that then we can start to say, what can we do about it?
We'll hold there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have more letters. We have many more topics to discuss as well. We invite you to join in on the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain make up the panel. We'll be back. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain making up the panel. We have a lot of letters, so let me get to those, and we will then move on to other topics, I promise. So, Irene says, I agree with Alan. Political zealots have always been around. It is up to their peers and those in leadership roles to denounce their extreme behavior before it gets out of hand. Remember Trump? Kevin McCarthy is not showing the leadership needed with Marjorie Greene. Then Wade says, how do you think Al Franken feels about Marjorie Taylor Greene holding office? Good point.
Good question.
Let's see. If we remember, I believe Comey played a big part in Trump winning and people being afraid of voting in a woman. I would say those were two main reasons that Hillary did not get in. Susie says, isn't gerrymandering partly to blame for crazies getting elected?
That's an interesting question. You know, we get a lot of that.
Yes.
You want to take it, Jim?
I was just going to say yes. But Alan, you may have a more nuanced answer.
Well, you know, what happens is that when we gerrymander, there are certain rules for gerrymandering. And one of them is you put all of the people of one persuasion in the minority party in one district, right? So that's what happened with Stefanik. So you have this district. Now we're about to lose two congresspeople, maybe one, maybe two, in the New York delegation. That's going to mean some people are going to really be endangered, and this whole thing is going to be done again. If the federal courts decide that they're going to say what the line should be, which they did the last time in New York State in some of the congressional elections, then the gerrymander doesn't really work. On the other hand, the Democrats are going to be doing the gerrymandering this time in New York. And, you know, that's fine. That's the devil we know. But what happens when the Republicans do it, and so on?
Jim?
Well, and I was just going to say, in some states, there's a lot more. The place where the minority plays out can be more of the kind of thing we're seeing in Georgia with Green.
Sure.
So, you know, again, that person only has to then run to a very small sector of the audience, of the political sphere. And I think that's, you know, part of what's caused this problem. And God, I'm tempted to go into a very long spiel. I won't. But suffice to say that the mathematical sophistication of how gerrymandering is done now, and particularly in those states where it has a very, very partisan flavor, mm-hmm. which particularly some of the small red states, you know, they really can get this down to the point where you can make a district that's almost impossible for someone else to win than the party that's chosen. And when you start getting into that, you know, again, that's something where getting through the primary means you've won the election. And that's certainly the case in Green's district.
Yeah. You know, in New York State, for whatever it's worth, and I know that it isn't, when the Republicans had the Senate for all of those years, they perpetuated their control, right, Jim? They perpetuated their control by saying, okay, we'll draw our districts. Assembly, you're Democrats, you draw your districts, and that's the way we'll do it. Then one day, as I have often said, the great computer on the wall, which did all of that mathematical modeling which you're talking about, turned around to the then Republican leader and said, sorry, boss, we haven't got enough to push around anymore. And that was the end.
Mm. Yeah, but in New York, you have more flexibility. I remember, Alan, the Democrat, yep. The Republicans were in danger of losing control of the Senate, and they just added a seat in a very, what they drew to be a very Republican district. And sure. Then the Democrat won it the first time out, so it didn't work. But it is amazing how you can manipulate districts to achieve what you want to achieve, and it ends up with the minority controlling the majority of what goes on.
That's what happened in New York.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, let's go to some more letters, if we can, and go to Peter. This is the one thing both sides have in common: we are addicted to outrage. Spencer says, a House committee for Ms. Green, what about ethics? There's a committee we never hear from anyway.
I assume he doesn't mean put her on it.
Yes, put her on the ethics committee. We don't worry about ethics. Susan says...
That's so sadly true.
Susan says, fortifying to hear Senator Danforth on PBS NewsHour last night speaking to how his conservative party has morphed into a party of grotesques. He just lays it on the line as to how the Republican Party is no longer recognizable. The more Republicans come out to say this, and I think they will, the better we will be. Is anyone sure that they will do that?
Especially if you've got 6-year Senate terms. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney just got elected, of course. And so, you know, he has a long time for all of this to go by, as opposed to the 2-term congressman. What do you think, Teresa?
Yeah, well, one of the things, I think Senator Danforth, and I'll circle back to that. Senator Danforth has said that his most... his worst political mistake was supporting Josh Hawley. But what's interesting there is that the financial backers are backing away from Hawley. And so will that happen elsewhere? Mm. The fundamental question is Liz Cheney the future of the House Republican Party, or is Kevin McCarthy? And I think 2 years from now, 4 years from now, who will prevail? Because that's the struggle that's going on.
Yeah, okay.
Liz Cheney is holding firm on basic democratic values, not Democrat,
small
Republican,
D, small
I mean
D,
constitutional.
Small D.
Yep. Small D, constitutional values. And Kevin McCarthy is skirting those in an effort to retain power. So the question is, will the money people do around the country what they're doing to Josh Hawley? And will that, you know, where will the money go?
Teresa, were those money people who were Trumpers, I'm not saying they all were, but the money people who were Trumpers, were they scared of him thinking that he was out of control and that there was no stopping him and that doing business as usual wasn't going to continue because you never knew what this... and I just got a letter from a psychologist who said, stop using the word crazy.
Yeah.
So there you go for what this crazy man, and he was crazy, had to do. I'm sorry if you were offended. But sometimes words are used appropriately, and if Ms. Green and Mr. Trump aren't crazy, I want to know who is, and I don't know why we can't use that word. It's a terribly important word.
Is wackadoodle better? Yeah.
Yeah, I like that one.
Diabolical is a bad
dangerous,
either.
Dangerous term. Well, the question has always been, where is the line? And I guess the line is when you go to the Capitol on January 6th, and you beat a police officer to death and beat 5 or 6 others so that they're, injured, significantly injured, and 150 others injured, and you smash down windows. I guess that is maybe the line, but not the line for these 60 House members who they came into their house. This is why I find it so offensive. These 60 members, they were there. They know what the implications of the lie were, right? Violence in the Capitol that has led to death of a police officer, injuries of many others, and a terrible bruise on our democracy globally. Yet they still, you know, support the lie of Trump saying, you know, it wasn't a proper transition. You know, it wasn't a fair vote. I don't get it. It's a problem for our country.
Let's go to more letters if we can. And we go to this one from Susan, who says, I'm as liberal as can be, but I think stripping Green of all influence in the House is more effective than voting her out. Levi says, love the show. Always happy when I have the chance to tune in. That said, I'm having some difficulty accepting Alan's repeated use of political prostitute when we're referencing some of these Republicans. It's insulting to prostitution and prostitutes.
He makes a good point.
These Republicans haven't earned the title. Fact is, these Republicans have never and could never hold a real job. They would have to, no issue with the illegality, but the work, that's a dirty four-letter word for these Republicans. And perhaps stop insulting the working class. We go to...
Okay, sarcasm.
Yeah, sarcasm alert, right. We need a sounder for that. Scott says, not just a laser, folks, but a Jewish space laser. She is nuts, but also anti-Semitic, which I think we mentioned, but anyway.
Well, I certainly did.
But she's wrong, though. It's actually the Illuminati, not the Jews who control the laser.
Now,
I have my control panel right here.
And what's the thing about the matzo balls? Wasn't there something about matzo balls?
No,
that was a writer.
That was a riff, I think.
I get it. I'm sorry about that.
A listener.
No, the and that went back to the Jewish part of it went back to the Rothschilds, correct? I mean, that goes to a really old conspiracy.
International bankers, the Rothschilds, were funding these satellites, which were beaming down laser beams that they were getting from the sun, and it was intended to create energy, but it missed its target, because it's very easy at that distance to miss your target, and it started all those fires. Bill Gates was involved, too.
I am deeply impressed and yet concerned that you know so much about that.
I was so confused by it. I looked it up and looked at the original language. It's just bizarro.
I know it's totally bizarre. And you know the other thing that's interesting is a lot of the stuff that sounds very bizarre, the QAnon stuff about pedophilia and, you know, cannibalism.
Right.
All of these are things that go back to famous conspiracy theories, many of them anti-Semitic. You know, some of them have names, you know, we call it, you know, that they're so famous. And yet they come back again and again and again in new guises because, you know, there's an audience for them. And, you know, other than somehow finding a way to call foul on them, there's not really anything to do.
I think some of in the Inquisition, aren't they? Some trace back to the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition?
Yeah, something called the blood libel goes back even before that.
Mm-hmm. Teresa?
Remember that yesterday, Leader McCarthy acted as if he wasn't even sure who these people were.
Right.
These are the people who came on January 6th into the Capitol with their, you know, flags and their banners. Right, they announced themselves. So for him to say, oh, I don't really know who they are, first of all, yes, they were in your house, and that would just, you know, why would he do that? Well, I know why he does it, but it's ridiculous.
It's a page from the book of Trump. I mean, when
absolutely.
Trump was at QAnon, he basically said, well, you know, they love the country. I don't know much about them, but they love this country.
They have nice things to say about me.
Right.
I don't know anything about them, but they do say nice things.
Yeah, and that for people to accept that, well, you know, I don't think people roundly accept it, but it is their way out of it. You know, it's their quick answer that sort of, you know, it's just, you know, avoid it.
Have we even begun to remember how many lies Trump told? I mean, you got his acolyte now telling lies, but I think we're losing sight of the thousands, the tens of thousands of lies that Trump told.
30,500 and something is what the Washington Post counted during his presidency.
And the last 2 months were real. That was a good. That was a good bumper crop.
Upwards, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Teresa.
But in the meantime, just as this kind of discussion was a distraction, Alan, you asked earlier, well, why did the finance people tolerate Trump? Well, because while Trump was distracting everybody with his behavior behind the scenes, they were getting what they wanted. They were getting the changes at EPA. They were getting at the changes at Health and Human Services. They were getting the changes at Interior so they could mine. They were getting the
judges
they wanted. And
yeah.
All under the cover of this just massive chaos that Trump was creating. And now we see it continue with this. Well, at the same time, you know, the Biden administration is trying very hard to work on the, you know, the problems, the economic problems of our country, foreign policy problems. He's giving a major foreign policy speech today. These continue. I hate to use the word distraction because it's very, very important, but it does take attention away from the need to build a national coalition around passing a stimulus package, around dealing with we need an infrastructure bill to, you know, essentially juice the economy. We need a clean energy bill to deal with climate change, all of these things. But we can't ignore this situation that's festering in our society.
And, you know, it may be a time of opportunity in a funny way. I heard a few different commentators. Rachel Maddox is one who talked about it very specifically about the oil.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel talked about it with respect to the oil companies, but it's also come out in some other things. A lot of the very big companies that had tremendous political power ended up doing very poorly under Trump because of COVID. And some of these people who may be backing away from Hawley, some of these people who may be starting to suddenly not be able to call the shots within the government, part of that is because they're, the first time ever, they're losing money. They're trying to figure out what to do. They're being forced to deal with the fact that they're going to have to make changes. And once the money is focused internally, it's hard to keep it, you know, you're not trying to preserve the status quo with your funds. So it may be a very interesting time politically because the back end of the political world is changing. And some of that we saw with the first Obama administration and the recession. It was very much the same kind of thing. You had political opportunities coming because some of the players had to leave the field either temporarily or long term.
Just look at General Motors. General Motors was pushing the Trump administration to back off on air emission standards and was trying to stop that. And as soon as Biden gets elected, what did they announce? They announced that they're phasing out gasoline automobiles in the next 15 years. I mean, it is a 180-degree turn. They're just looking where the money is, they're looking where the trends are, and then they're adapting to it.
What were you going to say,
Alan? I'd be interested.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Teresa.
Alan, I'd be interested in your thoughts on the this issue with oil is shifting the political landscape in the U.S., but also the global landscape. And what is it going to mean for Russia because of the dependence of their economy on oil revenues? And what's it going to mean for the Middle East? I mean, I think there's going to be a major shift, but I don't quite understand what it'll be.
Well, you couldn't be more right. We saw it coming when the United States started being one of the largest oil producers in the world. And all of a sudden, there wasn't this the necessity of this dependence on some of these characters over in the Mideast. But yes, I do think that that's going to have a great deal to do with the way things go politically now.
All right, we have about 5 minutes. Let me just go to a couple letters here. And then we'll move on. Tom says, the question of the day, why is America seemingly in love with QAnon and other mystical, magical cult beliefs? Trump's gift to the dumbing down of America. He encouraged a near total lack of critical thinking, leading by example, a president who never read a book, active dismissal of the value of academics, see sneers toward Dr. Jill Biden. And intelligence is a relatively concept for many, bolstered by and measured by how loud you can yell, the substance of which entirely is beside the point. Then we go to Emmy, who says, how many panel members have seen the movie The Social Dilemma on Netflix? It's a movie that everyone needs to see, in which tech experts, the people who develop the technology we all use, tell us exactly how we've gotten to where we are as a divided society full of cults and conspiracy theories. It is a scary, very disturbing movie. Jim, I assume you have seen it. Maybe not.
Yeah, I have seen it, and I've also talked to some of the people who were in it. I was not myself. You know, what can I say other than it's worth seeing? But more generally, you know, again, a lot of things are still portraying some very subtle things and some very, you know, saying this caused this, this caused this. It's a very complex situation.
For the rest of us,
you know,
I was just going to say, can you tell the audience what it was that this film was portraying?
Well, it's generally looking at how the tech economy, right, has grown, how, you know, sort of the Facebooks, the Twitters, the things like that, how much power they've taken in different ways by controlling certain kinds of information, but then how they've acted once they got that. So, you know, as a company gets bigger, it's rewarded for continuing to grow, not for doing good stuff. And so there was some of that. And then it also talked about some of the specifics of social media, things online, things like that. I must admit, I haven't seen it recently. I'd have to go back and refresh to remember which of several different arguments they made.
That was so long ago in the pandemic.
Well, but you see a lot of different things happening. It's that there were four or five things that came out around the same time.
Yeah.
Talking about different aspects of this. But really the key thing, Alan, is how much the five or six biggest companies in America and largely the world are all now these internet companies that live off of advertising, the micro-targeting stuff that Teresa was talking about before. And it's a very interesting, very complicated situation. Make a great Vox Pop or something where one could go into it much deeper. But, you know, again, there's a lot of these trends, and some of them, you know, do very positive things for society. Some of them do negative. And a lot of it is how it's exploited and by whom. And, you know, you can make parallels to things like, you know, large religion versus the people who really become religious exploiters and create cults and things like that. You know,
Who gets left out? So for example, Rex Smith on the Media Project has made the point a number of times that some of the big new platforms ought to be paying the old newspapers, you know, for their participation. Well, you know, the left outs will always be there. Hey, Joe, can I have just a minute to give a shout out, if I may, to the wonderful people who are conducting all of these clinics? I got a look in yesterday at a clinic in Great Barrington run by Fairview, the marvelous Fairview Hospital. It was extraordinary how well it went, with hundreds and hundreds of people lined up, wonderful police officers, wonderful people from the Fairview staff, and just doing this magnificent job. And I know this is going on all over, and I think these people haven't gotten the praise they deserve. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
Excellent.
You're here.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up the program. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, to share your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the panel. In other news, firearm sales soared in January after a mob-led assault on the U.S. Capitol and the arrival of a new administration that favors tighter gun restrictions. More than 2 million firearms were bought last month, according to the Washington Post analysis of federal gun background check data. That is an 80% year-over-year spike and the second highest one-month total on record. Background checks and sales of firearms and ammunition have been increasing in pace for months. The surge is in line with the record pace set in 2020. Nearly 23 million firearms were bought, representing a 64% jump year over year. Now, so the fact is that estimated firearm purchases climbed to $2.1 million in March early in the coronavirus pandemic when cities and states issued stay-at-home orders. Panic buying was common, with Americans hoarding toilet paper, diapers, cleaning supplies, and, oh yeah, guns. Then there was the killing of George Floyd, which set off a summer of racial justice protests and prompted retailers in some cities to board up windows. Firearm sales went even higher to 2.8 million in June, 2.5 million in July. Walmart removed gun and ammunition displays from thousands of its stores. In the fall, misinformation swelled amid one of the most divisive presidential campaigns in U.S. history. President Donald Trump refused to accept his loss, and then gun sales went higher. Then the January 6th pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to stop the counting of Electoral College votes, finalizing Joe Biden's victory. Mark Oliva is a public affairs director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, saying people saw all of this happening at the same time, and they became very concerned for their safety. Everybody in America is buying these guns. I'm a 47-year-old white guy living in the suburbs of D.C. It's not just people like me. That from the Washington Post. Mike Spain.
Yeah, I see the biggest rise was in the state of Michigan, where the militias are big and where they, where one of the militias plotted to kidnap the governor and put her on trial, whatever. I mean, it's fear. I think what you just identified are many different sources of fear, fear in transitions of the presidency, fear over racial unrest, fear over new background checks because you got a new president in there and a new Congress in there that favors more controls, even though the multitude of national surveys show that people want more controls over how guns are sold and who gets them and background checks, et cetera. But despite that, and even with the NRA kind of in their own disarray as they're going through bankruptcy and facing court challenges in New York for their, feather bedding of their president, it just shows you that fear overcomes everything else when it comes to things like guns and toilet paper, Joe.
Yes, of course, toilet paper. Yeah. Alan?
You know, I'm so depressed about this whole thing when it comes around, this gun thing, that I can't say. It is reflective, of course, as Mike says, of the fear that we have in this country. But it's also reflective of the fact that we have blatant racism. And that guns too often become, the sort of fallback that many in the population believe is going to be their last protection against being assaulted. And, of course, it's not true. And yet it is something. And by the way, we almost never see that. We never see or almost never see people busting into homes and being shot by homeowners because I think most gun owners know that if they shoot somebody, they're in real trouble. But I must say that it is the worst part of this country, as far as I'm concerned, this fixation with guns. I read somewhere that there's two guns for every person in the United States out there right now. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an amazing number. And, of course, as a result, a kid's going to play with it. Somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody in a fit of anger is going to kill a domestic partner. There are so many reasons to limit it, but we just can't learn about this.
And you're right, Alan. When we do hear about people like breaking into other people's homes, like in the case of Rand Paul, they just go in and beat the hell out of their neighbor. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. And it wasn't even in the home. It was outside.
Yeah.
And I used to be really very upset about that guy coming over and beating up Rand Paul. Now not so much.
Now you're over it. Yeah. Teresa.
those numbers are astounding in terms of the increase. It occurs to me that we're 10 days away from the anniversary of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School back in 2018. Valentine's Day, and that within 5 weeks of that shooting, as you remember, massive protests in the Capitol and all over the country. And I was thinking about all those people who poured out in the streets and how different, how far we've regressed since then, that, it appeared to be some progress on this gun issue. It's all part of the same issue we've been talking about all morning, and why do people think that this will make them safer? Why do they feel that they have to protect themselves? What's going on with our society, this disconnect and this level of anger? I mean, it's been fomented now for 4 years, and this is the consequence. And as Alan, put that so well, there's going to be, there will be consequences to the ownership of all of these guns, unintended guns.
Is there any way out? Do you see any way out, Theresa?
Are people going to give back their guns? I mean, I think that the Biden administration is going to lower the temperature, and I think that we all have a responsibility to lower the temperature and to try to create some more connectivity. I'm reading Putnam has a book out about this, isolation and how you rebuild connectivity. Robert Putnam from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we do that? I don't know. It's a problem. What do you think, Alan?
No, I started my little talk here by saying I was totally depressed about the gun situation in America. I really don't know what has to be done about it. But it is reflective of the societal split between the haves and the have-nots all too often, although there are certainly a lot of people who own guns. On the wrong side of the law, but it really is a very difficult situation to parse.
I mean, am I right to think that the silver lining, if there is such a thing to this story, is that the way that the Washington Post got the information, Mike, was through background checks? So at least there's that.
Yeah.
In her first ever, hey, it's me. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, certainly. Background checks are important, and limits on. I'd like to see another ban that doesn't have a time, a sunset on it, that would ban the sale of assault weapons, AK-47 type, AR-15 type weapons, and that'll be good. But as Alan said, there's two. I had heard three for every American, Alan. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but two is enough for every American. There's enough guns out there, and there's enough ammunition out there, that no matter what happens, it won't bring all those back in. And Australia did something after a massive, there was a mass killing in Australia back, I think, in the 80s or 90s, and they passed a lot of laws and confiscated guns and bought them back. But I don't really have any sense that could work in the United States, where we, as a culture, so embrace our firearms as a protection under the Constitution, and the interpretation of that continues to be pretty liberal, in the sense that it's pretty substantially supports everybody carrying around a Uzi. It's troubling. I don't know the answer.
Alan, I think you said something, too, that was very, very important about the economic inequality. I think that gets to all of the issues that we've been talking about this morning. The economic divide in this country is at a really difficult place, and you see it. I mean, Amazon, in just the last quarter alone, made $100 billion, right, on the backs of employees who are not paid enough, and in the process, how many small businesses did they drive out of business?
Did we lose Teresa?
Uh-oh.
I think we
Joe
lost Teresa.
Teresa still there?
I think we lost Teresa mid-sentence.
We've been talking
about. There we go. Teresa, we lost you for a second. If you can say your last line, that would be great.
I said the economic divide really crosses over all of the issues that we talked about this morning. And Alan, I think it was very important for him to raise that, because that's really an underlying factor in so much of what we're talking about.
All yes. right. Let's see. We have just about 4 minutes, and I want to go to one final story here as we wrap up on this Thursday morning. I want to give Jim the moment, a moment to talk about Amazon, their outgoing CEO, Jeff Bezos, and their new guy, Andy Jassy, who is not new, but is a what is being described by the New York Times as a brain double for Bezos, of what this means for tech overall.
It's funny, Joe. I was listening to the show yesterday and thinking how happy I was that I wasn't there to ask that question. No, I mean, it's really hard to know exactly what's going on there. I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference. When, you know, I use the analogy of Gates and Microsoft, which several people on your show did yesterday. He moved out of the company. The company didn't really change in any major way. He had developed a culture to the level that, you know, it'd be very hard to change that culture. I think, you know, Amazon is like that. Bezos is, you know, likely to go on to other things. But I don't see Amazon as a company that was so tied to its leader the way some other companies are that this change will make a big difference. And, you know, what I've read about the new guy, I don't know these people at that level. No one with that much money talks to me. But there doesn't seem to be a feeling among the people I know who track this kind of stuff that this is going to have a big impact. Amazon has done incredibly well during COVID. Some of it, the exploitation that Teresa mentions, but some of it simply that, you know, by staying home, everybody's ordering stuff, and
right.
that's in their favor. And, you know, they're one of the companies we were talking before about how, you know, the amazing power gained by a few companies in the new economy and how that fights against the companies in the old economy. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but I don't think we're going to see a different Amazon in any major way.
Especially because the same guy is going to be running it who is always running it. He moves his chair to be the executive chairman of the board or whatever. But in the end, you can't even imagine his successor, if that's what you want to call him, who has always mirrored the boss, is going to not check in with the boss when the moment comes of any decision.
I wonder what Jeff Bezos has in mind. I mean, you know, he could turn into a media mogul. He could buy Fox News. He could buy the New York Times. He has so much money, he could buy anything. He owns.
They bought the Washington Post. He bought the Washington Post.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a couple $100 million. I mean, that's like nothing to
gum money.
Yeah, right. I mean, so, you know, whether it's media and politics and influence that way, whether it's something altruistic, which Bill Gates did so admirably, you know, it doesn't seem like Bezos is gated that way. No pun intended. But the, you know, it will be interesting to see now that he's not on the daily, you know, the daily operations of the company, whether he will turn to something. Maybe he'll just compete with Elon Musk in space, and that'll be fun to watch.
And don't be so sure.
Maybe he has a new woman. Who knows?
Yeah. He's got a new woman.
One of the things I read out there.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's going to be a prenup if that ever turns into a marriage.
I thought it did already, no?
Well, I applaud what his ex-wife did with her money. It certainly helped in the Capital District and all over the country. So.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
remind us what it was again.
Oh, she gave millions, right?
To?
Enormous amounts of money all over the country, including to youth groups in the Capital
right.
region. And it was it was non-prescriptive.
Yeah.
You could do
it
what you want, but basically to assist in helping with young people.
Oh, yeah, I remember
but
that.
But I just want to say you do not have to buy at Amazon to get what you need during the pandemic. I can speak from experience.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being here. Thank you so much. By the way, just because I finally got it, Mackenzie Scott, the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos, gave $4.2 billion to charity. last year. That is a lot of money. $4.2 billion. Okay, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Be well. Alan, thank you so much. Jim, Teresa, and Mike, thank you. We'll be right back.